hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Althea, and my sobriety date is April 27th, 2016. My childhood was kind of painful for me. I didn't have any major traumas that I know of, but I grew up in a very poor household. My mother has quite a bit of mental illness. She didn't work. She never learned how to drive a car. Our house was very chaotic. My parents divorced when I was 8, and that was really difficult for me. And my father's parents died when he was very young. A little bit of some emotional detachment there. So it was really hard for me. I felt very alone a lot of the time. And I didn't really have... I don't want to say that I don't have role models, and I don't want to act like I'm not grateful for my parents, because I am. I know that they did the best they could, but it wouldn't be what you would consider a healthy, nurturing environment. And I felt like I didn't have people that I could relate with as far as role models go, that I could look to and say, this is how you're supposed to live life. This is how we deal with things. I didn't have that. And so I felt lost a lot of the time, and I was kind of just feeling my way through. So I did well in school. I was like the teacher's pet in elementary school. I got made fun of for it, but that was like a solace for me, because I could go to school and kind of get some encouragement and attention and validation, and I enjoyed that. And then I think probably at some point that ended, possibly when I went into junior high. Junior high was terrible. And that was when I started using. I started hanging out with some older kids, and at some point, you know, in those situations, in my head, I was like, well, I do, you know, there's no peer pressure, and I did what I wanted to do, and there's part of that is true. I mean, I did make choices. However, you know, when you're in those situations and you're the young one and you're seeking approval, you kind of just do whatever. So I did. So I started smoking pot and drinking alcohol when I was 12 or 13. I hear people talk about how they started using, and maybe it clicked right in and they knew that they felt whole and that that was what they wanted. I don't remember having those thoughts, but I do remember just taking every opportunity to use whatever I could. And it started off with smoking pot on the weekends and drinking alcohol whenever I could get it. You know, it's not super easy to get when you're that age, but and eventually I was drinking several times a week, and then I was the one like bringing a half gallon of Captain Morgan's to school in my backpack and like going and taking nibs in the bathroom. So we would sneak off, you know, like a lot of kids do, and smoke weed in the woods or in the field or wherever, and in our friends' cars, and it didn't take long for it to go to like whatever else, you know. I think I started using ecstasy a lot when I was like 15, 16, and I used it regularly. You know, all of this, really whatever was placed in front of me, like if I kind of liked it, I would keep doing it until it got to a point where, you know, maybe it was too painful or I would get too depressed after, which was the case with ecstasy. But at some point, I did graduate high school. Somehow I graduated with honors. I skipped all the time, so I don't know how that happened, but I graduated high school and I took a year off, and then I did a commuter college where I drove in, had an apartment, and I drove in for classes. And somewhere in there, I actually think it was like my junior, senior year in high school, I had friends who, a friend's friend's mom had cancer, and she had OxyContin prescription. And he would go, like we would pull up, and he would just run in and take some pills out of her bottle, and then he would sell them. And I'm a girl, and they were boys, so they gave them to me for free. And that was how you know, my opiate addiction started. I mean, I consider myself to be an addict from way back, like pretty much as soon as I started using anything, it was just a given that I would just continue doing it. And I don't remember ever trying not to, but I do remember joking as a teenager about drinking and kind of being like, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, it's a big joke, no big deal. And I had no education and I had no understanding of what that meant or what repercussions it would have later on in life. And like I said, my parents were not involved. Or they were to the best of their ability, but not to the extent where they intervened in any way or even made comments or anything like that. So when I started using opiates, it was like a weekend thing. And then I would pick it up and drop it off. I did other stuff in between, still drinking a lot, still smoking a lot of pot. And when I was in my early 20s, I started selling cocaine and crack, and I made a lot of money. And in my mind, it felt good because I grew up really poor, so I could make quick money and was not thinking about the people that were being harmed by it, including not thinking about how it was harming myself. And also in my head, I said, well, I don't like cocaine, so I can sell this, no big deal, and then I'll have all this money. And that didn't work. I ended up doing that, and then I started buying opiates daily, and eventually I was doing so much that I couldn't afford it. I went into a methadone clinic, and I did that for years and years and years, doing other drugs on top of it. I was doing heroin on top of it. I started using intravenously, and then intravenously daily, and then multiple times a day. And that's kind of how this thing works. You do more and more and more, and you don't get the effect that you used to have. So you continue to do more and more and more until you get to a point of like complete desperation where it just doesn't work anymore and you have no fucking clue what to do. And that happened to me several times, and I would try to maneuver it on my own and try to like cut back on my own and lower the amount that I was using or allot a certain amount for certain parts of the day to be able to get by or switch to something different. And none of that ever worked, of course, because that doesn't work. And eventually I caught some legal charges. I had some felony drug trafficking charges for bringing drugs into the state. And interesting fact, I was on bail for 8 months while I was waiting to be indicted, which is a long time to not know what's going to happen with your life, on methadone, scared as hell to go detox in jail. And just to give you an idea of what addiction does to your brain and like the logic you're using, I was horribly scared to detox in jail. And how did I deal with that worry and that fear? I used way more. I mean, honestly, on top of that, I just wanted to die. And I would drive to work in the morning and I had no hope at all. And I would drive to work in the morning and I would get near bridges and in my mind, I would just drive off the edge of the bridge. I was like, I can't do this. But I kept, that like wasn't an option for me for whatever reason. Like I didn't really want to die. I think deep down, I just needed some kind of hope and I needed something else, but I didn't know what that something else was. And I ended up making it through that. I didn't get jail time. I didn't get probation. I've been enabled a lot because I think I look innocent and I can make things sound good and I'm educated, which I wouldn't say is a good thing as far as my addiction goes because it enabled me to keep it going. There were no major consequences where I was like, okay, I need to get my shit together. And I knew, as far as like the word addict, like I said, I would joke about being an alcoholic, but I never tried to stop. That was early on. Somewhere, somewhere along the line, like when I first went to treatment, there was no question. I knew at that point I had tried everything else. There was no question in my mind. I knew that I was an addict. You know, I could read through the literature and be like, yep, 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 that's all me. There was no question for me. I don't know where that happened. I don't know where the line is. And I'm not somebody who can look back and be like, that was the bag of dope that I did that I knew that I was an addict. I didn't really think about it. It was just part of my life. It was just part of my life. I had wanted treatment at some level from probably in my early 20s, so 12 or 13 years ago. Before I went into the methadone clinic, I knew like treatment would be an ideal option. I didn't want to go into a clinic where they were telling me that I was going to be on medication for the rest of my life, which I didn't buy into that. In my head, I was like, I'm going to figure this out later. It was a really bad decision. But I knew that it would be ideal, but the state that I live in, Maine, they really don't have a lot of treatment options. There's a huge opioid epidemic. There's people dying all over the place all the time and lives being destroyed, and there's hospital detoxes where they cannot turn you away for not being able to pay, but they will not take you if you're coming off of opiates. You have to be coming off of something that, they say you can't die from opiate withdrawal, which is mostly true, but there can be complications that can kill you. But if you're coming off of other drugs like benzos and alcohol, you can die. So because of how bad the opiate epidemic is, they just couldn't handle all the people coming in and going through, and you go through detox and you go right back out and use because you need treatment. Like, you need something else. Just taking the drugs away for 5 to 7 days is not enough. You're not even really done with withdrawal at that point. So there was that wasn't an option for me. There's a couple of treatment centers that are state funded that there's very long waiting lists. I got on one once, and I was on it for like 6 months, and you have to call every 2 weeks. I don't know if you know anything about what it's like to be a drug addict, but you might be on it and have serious willingness at one point, but if stuff doesn't come through, it's really hard to be determined to continue doing that. And I wasn't, and I didn't keep checking up. Also, I needed to detox first, and I couldn't do that. There was detoxing off methadone is almost impossible by yourself. But so I knew from early on that I needed treatment. It was just a matter of the right timing, where I was willing and there was something available. I went to treatment 3 times. I went the first time in August of 2015, and I went to Desert Hope. And I was coming off a long, long run of methadone and heroin and benzos, and I was really sick. And it was my first exposure to treatment, and I didn't know what to expect. But as far as getting in there, I mean, the people that I spoke with were really helpful. They flew me there, had someone pick me up at the airport. It was very smooth, fairly welcoming. It's a scary thing going to a new place where you don't know anybody and across the country, and you're sick, and you have no idea what you're doing with your life, and you have no idea what to expect. So it was scary. That part was scary. But, you know, it wasn't, I didn't make it through that treatment center because it was really difficult for me. I was just very sick, and I guess I wasn't mentally prepared to deal with. I knew it was going to be difficult, but it was a lot more difficult than I thought it would be. So I ended up going home, and I relapsed. I mean, I was in a relapse. I never really got clean. I did a short-term detox and then left the treatment center and went and used. And then I went home, and I stayed out in that relapse for 2 months. And then one of the alumni coordinators or somebody from American Addiction Centers reached out to me and said, you know, are you okay? Are you still thinking about treatment? And, you know, I had never thought about it this way, but, man, who knows when I would have ended up back in treatment if they didn't call and say, hey, you know, what's going on with you? Are you okay? And do you need help? Because I did, in the back of my mind, I still wanted to get clean. I just didn't know when or how that was going to happen. And that whole mentality of just one more, just one more, just one more, because that's like what we know for comfort. And change, especially when it comes to getting clean, is horribly scary. It's very, very scary. So anyway, they called me. They worked with my insurance again and helped me out, got me to a different treatment center. They really listened because the first time I was like, it was too much for me to be in Vegas. And the treatment center that I went to, I don't think it was a bad treatment center. I just think that for me, I needed something different. And the one that they had offered this time was the Oxford Treatment Center, and it's set on a little lake, and there's cabins and woods, and I'm a Maine girl. I like, you know, flowers and trees and water and all that pretty nature stuff, and it was really peaceful. So I was still really sick, and but it was a really peaceful place, and that helped. Everything in my life and my mind has changed since I've been clean. I have a network of people that I can turn to when I'm having problems. And I know this is common for a lot of people in active addiction, and we isolate ourselves, and the world is very scary when you're in a place like that. And for me, like, I didn't have people to talk to, or I wasn't willing to talk to the people that I had out of fear or whatever. That, you know, to find out how to deal with the stuff I was going through. And as soon as I left treatment, one of the things that was recommended of me was to go to 12-step meetings, and I did that. Really, I did almost everything they told me to do because I could not go back to the way things were. That was the only thing I was sure of, was I cannot go back to that. So I went to 12-step meetings. I eventually got a sponsor. It took me a little longer than some, and I worked the 12 steps, and I was basically unemployable when I got clean. I hadn't had a real job in a long time. My head was a mess. I mean, I was depressed all the time. I had anxiety about everything. Just like waking up in the morning was scary for me. And I had all the stuff from my brother's death, and it was just a lot. And getting clean and using the tools that were provided for me has allowed me to be able to deal with that stuff and keep going. They say that addiction is primarily an inability to deal with life on life's terms, which means we have emotions, stuff happens, we have emotions, and our brain misinterprets them and malfunctions, and we're like, we don't know how to deal with this, so we do all this stuff to deal with it. And most of it's very unhealthy and causes consequences in our lives. That's mostly not the case now. Like, I still think crazy sometimes, but I know what to do. Like, I know to call people and say, this is what I'm thinking, and then they'll say, okay, that's crazy, now do this. And I trust them because we built a relationship and I listen to what they say. For people that are on the fence about coming to treatment, it's very important for you to know that if you're anything like me, you're in a place of no hope, and you don't understand, you can't see. We want to see, and we want to understand how things are going to work. We want to know what the outcome is going to be. And going to treatment is scary. You don't know what the outcome is going to be, and no matter what you think it will be, it's not going to be that. So there is hope. There is many, many, many people who go through treatment and are able to have a life beyond their wildest dreams by getting clean and staying clean. And for me, it was a 12-step fellowship that helped me remain clean. But it is possible, and you just have to have this much faith, just a little bit. And just know that if it worked for others, it can work for you. Community is the thing, one of the main things that I've lacked all of my life. A sense of connectedness, a sense of belonging. I've always felt apart from and not a part of. It's a common theme throughout my whole life. And getting clean and being part of a 12-step fellowship for me, and, you know, the same thing when I was in sober living, and we did the alumni nights, and we went to meetings together, and we lived together, and it was essential to have people to turn to and to love them and allow them to love you back. The relationships that I've built and the community that I've built since I've been clean is the most rewarding thing. If I could say there was one thing, the most rewarding thing is being able to be there for people that I care about and have them be there for me. There is nothing that makes me feel more loved then to be able to give that to them and receive it from them. And I have never experienced that in my life. Truly have never, not like that ever in my life. You know, my family and I, we love each other, but there's all this stuff, right? Because that's how families work. There's all this stuff that we don't necessarily talk about it, and we don't know how to deal with it. And it's like blockages to having that level of a relationship. And, you know, we're working on that. But as far as in recovery, I really think that if there's one thing you could pick, it's a whole program and there's lots of tools you could use, but if there was one thing I could pick, it truly would be the relationships and the community that I've built.